Shrink Wrap Radio number 293, A Jungian Approach to Fairy Tales with Tom Elsner.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Tom Elsner, is a Jungian analyst and also a core faculty member at the Pacifica Graduate Institute. We'll be discussing his work on understanding fairy tales. You can find out more about his background by visiting our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Tom Elsner, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's so good to have you here. If I recall correctly, I got your name sometime back from another Jungian analyst, Monica Wickman.
Yeah, Monica and I trained in Switzerland together, and she's just wonderful. I think one of the world's great dreamers, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's not something that I knew about her, but that's good to know. She's made herself pretty available to the show, and so she's certainly one of my go-to people for interviews.
Great. Well, it's good. Great. I appreciate the chance to be here.
From the bio that you sent me, I see that you were originally trained as an attorney. Now, I have the impression that attorney and Jungian analyst might represent two different poles of cognitive function. I would guess that there might be a story behind your transition from the one to the other. How did that come about?
Yeah, well, that's really true. I would say, in my experience, at least two poles of cognitive function. Oh, wow. I remember... For instance, training as a therapist when I was getting my master's degree and being in classes that involved things like emotions and feelings. And I remember just sitting there and all the time feeling like I just wanted to say, objection, you're irrelevant. Objection, you're irrelevant. When are we going to really learn something important? You know, so there is this sense of being trained, at least being trained as a lawyer to, you know, to be able to think linearly.
Yes.
To be concise, to be logical and practical. And so the more symbolic ways of thinking that rely on emotions, you know, were a trick for me, definitely an inferior part of my personality that had to develop.
But something must have been calling you to move in that direction.
Yeah, I would say that was really the case. People sometimes say, why did you choose to become an analyst as opposed to a lawyer? And the word choose, I mean, really is just too weak of a word, really not the right word. I mean, it was really something deeper in my soul that revolted against that direction in my life really strongly. And that took the form initially as a depression and as the sense of a loss of meaning. And I had dreams, really deep archetypal dreams at the time that involved the destruction of the world. Dreams like all the animals in the jungle had been slaughtered. I mean, really, really horrific. I would say a very strong inner reaction against that path in life for me.
Wow. You know, I've encountered a number of people who went all the way through law school, did all the very hard work that represents, only to discover, maybe even before they ever practiced, that, hey, this isn't really for me.
Yeah, so, you know, and that's often not a conscious choice because if you change directions in that way, it's a sacrifice also of time and money and prestige and, you know, a lot of the things the ego is often invested in.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
Plus maybe parents who might have helped to support one through the process and so on.
Yeah, that was really true for me. I mean, at that time, around the time that I was switching careers, I guess you could say it was a quarter-life crisis. My parents had died just recently, so that was part of the of the story, I think that was part of the meaning of it for me, had gone with that.
Well, speaking of stories, let's turn to the main subject of our interview here. I have the impression that you periodically teach a course on the interpretation of fairy tales at Pacifica Graduate Institute. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right, Dr. Dave. This is a course I teach in the counseling psychology program to people that are becoming therapists. So it really is, I would say, a course in applied fairy tales. We're not training folklore scholars, but really a class in, I think, primarily learning to think metaphorically and symbolically as distinct from literally, and learning the language, the archetypal language of the imagination, especially as it applies to dynamics in psychotherapy, transference dynamics, dreams, symptoms.
Well, I'm so jealous. I never had a class like that, and I would have loved it, and I'm really jealous of your students for getting that exposure. I have a longstanding interest in fairy tales myself, and when I was in elementary school, I don't know if it was like this when you came through, but in the old days, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we had standard readers provided by the state. And I seem to recall that there would be some fairy tales in the back of the book.
Oh.
And just like dessert, you were expected to read through the whole book, and you wouldn't get to the fairy tales until the end of the course if they made it that far. So I always went straight for the dessert.
Well, that says something about you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, well, it does.
Yeah. It's probably not every boy that's zooming straight to the back of the book to read those types of stories. So already that says something about you, that you were fascinated by those types of stories.
I think I probably had some exposure to them, too. I think that my mother probably read me some of those stories even before I went to school. What do you think it is about fairy tales that leads to their fascination for children? Because they seem to stay with us for the rest of our lives. What do you think that is?
Well, I think in a nutshell, I would say it's because they're true. Fairy tales are true, but they're not literally true.
Right. Say a little bit more about that.
Well, I think the reason I would say they're true is that they're metaphorically true stories. Now, the problem in our culture is that we're typically trained to think logically and linearly and factually. So we are, at some point, this isn't true for kids, little children, but at some point in life, we learn things are either true or they're false. They're either literally true or they're a lie. For instance, Joseph Campbell in the DVD A Hero's Journey recounts this really humorous but really important story when he was once on a radio talk show, actually. But the interviewer was asking him about myths, and the interviewer said to him, well, a myth, that's a lie. And Campbell said, no, it's a metaphor. And the interviewer said, no, it's a lie. And they went back and forth about that. So I think it's just because there are fascinating stories that grip kids, and they continue to grip us as adults in different ways because they're true, and they're getting to really basic core truths about the human situation, basic fears, existential predicaments, longings. They touch deep into the archetypal core of the human personality.
You know, one of the things that triggered for me as you say that is when you mention fears, and children, of course, are especially prone to fear because, in fact, they're small and vulnerable. And many of the fairy tales are quite dark. And it seems to me that in contemporary culture, we sort of try to protect our children from the dark side. And yet, as you point out, the fairy tales are true, and they're speaking to the truth, maybe, of the child's fear.
I think that's very well put. There's a really excellent book on fairy tales written by Bruno Bettelheim, who is a Freudian analyst.
Oh, yes, I remember him.
Yep. You remember him? Yeah, The Uses of Enchantment. And that's primarily a book on how fairy tales affect children and why they're important for children. And he says a lot of the same things you were just saying. For instance, we think of our little children as being little darlings that are completely innocent and really, they're filled with fears and aggressions.
Yeah.
And dark aspects to their personalities. And Bettelheim's idea was that the fairy tale is important in part because it provides a mirror for those. So the child can see that those unconscious dimensions of its personality in the story, and also a way through the story.
You know, I had completely forgotten about Bruno Bettelheim and that book, which I read probably when I was in graduate school. Mm. So, you know, maybe it was back there somewhere in my unconscious. So thanks for bringing that forward. And I've got three grandchildren, little grandchildren, and the middle one, who's like 3 years old, about to turn four, has a recently arrived baby brother or little brother who's about, I guess he's pushing two or maybe just turned two. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, not only fear, but aggression. And I've seen her get quite aggressive with him, you know. Mm-hmm. There'll be these little accidental shoves and pushes and little sort of glancing blows, you know, designed to fool adults, should anybody be looking to look like.
or
hugging him like a little too hard. The lady doth protest too much.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I have two boys. They're now 6 and 9 years old. When they were younger, I used to make up stories for them at night. And they would always want to pick one animal each. So one might pick, oh, I want to have a hear a story about the jaguar. And the other might say, oh, and I want to hear a story about the tarantula. So I'd have to make up a story about a tarantula and a jaguar.
That's great.
And they always wanted the animals to fight. Always.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But there was ways that in the imagination that things would spontaneously come out where they would fight, but they would reconcile and, you know, something new would happen through the story. And those are really gripping to my boys. Fascinating.
Oh, that's good. That sounds like fun. And it sounds like a rich time for the three of you.
Yeah, it was definitely a bonding time.
Yeah. Now, I know that we mentioned Bettelheim, and I know that Marie-Louise von Franz did the seminal Jungian work on fairy tales, and I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that I have yet to dive into her tomes. Many of my listeners will be ahead of me there. My own intellectual understanding of fairy tales comes from my reading of Joseph Campbell, who you mentioned earlier. Is there a way that you could give us maybe just a sense of the highlights of von Franz's understanding of fairy tales?
Sure. You know, Mary Louise von Franz was probably Jung's most prominent and devoted student, and she was really steeped in fairy tales, wrote a lot of books on fairy tales, and did a lot of research on the subject. Her main take on it, as distinct from Bettelheim, she's approaching the subject primarily from its importance to adults and primarily culturally. So for von Franz, fairy tales are like the not yet understood dreams of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
The compensatory stories to the prevailing values and myths of the culture, she thinks, show up in the folklore. So for her, also, these very short archetypal narratives in which they're, you know, typically is a miller starts out the story, or a soldier, or there was once a king. These abstract skeletal figures represent for von Franz the clearest and simplest expression of collective unconscious contents and processes. So they are very simple, clear ways to get in touch with the archetypal and collective dimensions of the unconscious for von Franz. And for that reason, they're valuable in psychotherapy, because the language of dreams parallels the language of the fairy tale, and vice versa.
Yeah, you mentioned that fairy tales are compensatory, and I know that the idea of compensation is really important in Jungian theory. Just help our listeners that might not be familiar with that concept. What do you mean when you say fairy tales are compensatory?
They tell us what we don't know, but what we should know to become whole or complete. They fill in what's missing from the conscious attitude. Jung thought that's primarily what a dream is doing in the life of the individual. We are dreaming of what we don't yet know. We're dreaming of what we need to become more in touch with. so-called shadow sides of our personality, for instance, show up in dreams. Von Franz's idea with folklore is that it's doing a similar thing, but culturally. So, for instance, in the Grimm's stories, if we take those stories, which were written down by the brothers Grimm's after they collected them from oral storytellers in the 19th century, the collective culture of the time in Europe is Christian, primarily Christian. And so what happens in the folklore is that a lot of pagan imagery shows up in the folklore. A lot of the sense of a spirit in nature, for instance, of dealing with witches, of talking animals, of redemption motifs that involve trickery and deceit and lying. Very non-Christian themes show up in the folklore. One could say the repressed feminine world shows up in the folklore very much of the Brothers Grimm stories.
So the other side of Christianity is showing up, the stuff that's sort of denied or suppressed in Christianity.
Absolutely. That's von Franz's theory. And mm-hmm. one can really see it, for instance, in the European stories, I think, especially there.
What's the difference between fairy tales and myths? Are they the same thing or are they different?
I would say they're very different. As Joseph Campbell said, a myth is just someone else's religion. If you're inside a mythology, it's your truth, right? If I'm a Hindu, that's not a mythology for me, but a truth. Or if I'm a Christian, if I would refer to the Christian myth, that would already mean that I'm outside of it. So myths are really the encoded forms for a culture of what is true and ways that everyone should be. They're models, they're examples. And fairy tales are different than that, aren't they? I mean, at least the fairy tales, that the way we understand them now and are exposed to them, they're not put forth as truths. They have a lighter touch to them, don't they?
Yes, definitely.
They're not codified into dogmas about how everyone ought to behave.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, I think, one way in which they're different. Von Franz's idea also is that fairy tales are more purely archetypal, and myths typically have a lot of cultural material in them. The okay. Greek myths are Greek. The Judeo-Christian myth really has a lot of cultural inflection.
Mm-hmm.
And the fairy tales are a little more universal.
Okay, and you mentioned that there's a relationship between fairy tales and dreams in terms of the kind of underlying metaphorical thinking that's going on. And I'm guessing that, as with dreams, there might be many potential levels of meaning or analysis in any given fairy tale. For example, there might be a personal interpretation, a cultural interpretation, an archetypal one, maybe others. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I would say in the true fairy tale or folk tale, there isn't any personal level at all, which what makes it a distinctive form of story. For instance, there's no author to a folk tale.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows who invented the story. It's like a recipe for chicken soup. Who made it up? Nobody knows. Here it is.
Yeah. I guess when I say personal, though, I mean, if I were to take this, a fairy tale, and apply it to my own life, then... That's what I would mean by personal.
Mm. Well, that definitely is true. I mean, these things impact us in our personal lives. So I guess then it would be a way of phrasing the question, what does the story mean to me?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to the culture that I'm in?
Mm-hmm.
And then what might be its more universal archetypal significance?
Yeah.
And one can certainly approach the story from all those three levels.
Okay. I very much enjoyed reading your paper that you sent me on animals and analysis, the Grimm's tale about the three languages, which I had not heard or remembered. You start that paper off with a dream you had when you were just beginning your analytic training in Jungian analysis in Switzerland. Let's start off, maybe you would be willing to share that dream with us now.
Sure, Dr. David, I'd be happy to. Yeah, this was when I was first training as an analyst in Switzerland. I had a dream, and I guess you could say it was my initiatory dream for my analytic training. And the short version of the dream was this. I was speaking with one of the older male analysts there, and we were talking about cases, psychotherapy cases. And this older man had learned in the dream I knew to, through very hard work, to understand the sounds of animals. And in a dream, I wanted to learn that too, and I wondered if I could learn that also.
Yeah. So what was your initial sense of that dream?
No sense at all. I thought it was completely strange. In fact, I didn't really like it because here I was in Switzerland spending all this time and money and, you know, training as an analyst, and it's a serious thing. And is this really the reason I've come all the way to Switzerland to learn animal sounds? Really? So I don't know. It didn't really mean anything. I mean, it wasn't quite nonsensical, but I think it was at best quaint or strange.
Well, in your paper, I seem to recall that eventually you sort of figured out that the dream was somehow compensating for being too much in your head, calling you to the instinctual life of the body. Do I have that right?
Yeah, eventually I wound up there. I would say that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say compensating for an idea that I had about analysis or psychotherapy. The dream seemed to be saying, I could say now, it seems to be saying that at least one of the things that's very important about psychotherapy, because remember that was the context of the dream, we were talking about cases, was what you could call a kind of natural wisdom or an instinctive wisdom that's different from the theories and preconceptions and conscious ideas of the therapist. That's what an animal has, how a bird knows how to find its way home, how a spider knows how to spin its web, a kind of instinctive wisdom.
Yes.
That is different than an intellectual, conceptual theorizing.
A few years after that dream, as part of your exams, and it almost seemed synchronistic as you told it, that as part of your exams, you were asked to interpret the Grimm's fairy tale, The Three Languages. And as I mentioned, that's not one that I was familiar with. Maybe you can share that story with us.
Sure. Yeah, that was not one I was familiar with either. As a few years into the program, one of the hoops we have to jump through or initiations is we get locked in a room for 4 hours and they throw a fairy tale at us that we haven't seen and we have to write an interpretation. So that was the one I got, this Grimm story, The Three Languages. And the story in brief is about there's an aged count in Switzerland who has one son. And the son, according to this father, is so stupid that he just can't learn anything. And the father becomes very frustrated with his son. So he says, well, since I can't get anything into your head, no matter how hard I try, I'm going to send you away for a year to study with a master in a strange city, and we'll see what he can do with you. So he sends the son away for 1 year. At the end of the year, the son comes back, and the father says, son, what did you learn? He says, father, this year I learned what the dogs say when they bark. And the father just didn't like that, as you can imagine. So year two, to another city, another master, he learns the language of the frogs. Then year three, the language of the birds. And at this point, the father is infuriated. He orders his servants to take the boy out into the woods and have him killed. And as is common in folklore, the servants take pity on the boy and let him go. He wanders around the world, eventually coming to another town where he is able to redeem this town from a curse that involves rabid dogs that are locked up in a dungeon below. And because he can speak their language, he can redeem them from this curse. And eventually the boy actually becomes the new pope because he can speak the language of these animals. And as he is the pope, he doesn't know one word of the mass, the story says, but the birds come down and whisper the whole thing into his ears. So that was the story of The Three Languages. Now, when I read that, you know, this story about a boy going away to a strange city to learn from teachers there how to understand the sounds of animals, I thought, oh my God, this is my story.
It reminded you of that dream at the beginning of your analysis, right?
It brought that dream freshly back to mind, the dream in which I had traveled to Switzerland, and there I was learning from some teacher to understand animal sounds. So I thought, I know what this guy is learning. He's learning to become a Jungian analyst. That's what's going on in the story.
Right.
Yeah. So that really sort of opened my eyes to the possibility that there could be some importance to that dream motif, and it wasn't just an idiosyncratic or kind of nonsensical thing that appeared in my dream.
Well, as you looked into Tales more, actually, I believe it turned out that the ability to understand the language of the animals is a kind of motif that recurs in other stories from around the world. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. This is what we would call an archetypal motif. In other words, it's not a motif that comes from my personal life. I was completely unaware of it personally. And it's not a motif that appears in my culture, say the Southern California 20th century culture that I'm from.
Yeah.
But so it's an example of an archetypal motif. And those are motifs that one has to do research to learn about. So as I began to dig into other stories, myths, shamanism, what one really finds is that this idea of understanding the sounds of animals goes back all the way to ancient Egypt. One can find it all over the world in shamanism. It appears in many folk legends from around the world, where it appears as really the greatest and most valuable gift that can be given. And it's a theme that has universal significance in a very meaningful way.
Well, what's the larger significance of this theme then?
Well, I would say in a nutshell, it's the ability to connect to what we would call the wisdom of nature.
Yeah, that does put it in a nutshell. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we've grown far from, at least, you know, in the culture that I'm from, the idea that there even could be such thing as a wisdom in inner and in outer nature. Different than being intellectual or clever or theoretical, wisdom has a lot to do with survival. And Jung in the Red Book, I think Monica Wickman talked about the Red Book with you. I know Nancy Ferlotti did an interview with you about Jung's Red Book.
Yes.
Jung refers to this split in his experience between what he called the spirit of the depths and the spirit of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And the language of the animal for me is really a language of the depths. It's a language that's a non-intellectual, non-conceptual language. It has to do with emotion, with the body, with something more primal in us and older and instinctual than the spirit of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And this language of the depths, for me, really, it's the archetypal language of the soul. The word animal is related to the word in Latin for soul, anima. And so I think it's the ability to understand what we would call the mythopoetic language of the soul, at least in part.
You know, I never made that connection before between animal and anima. Mm-hmm. And it's such an important connection that you've just drawn for us. Let me give you a quote from your paper. You write, "Fairy tale interpretation is a process of self-discovery, an individuation process involving the participation of the conscious and the unconscious." Maybe you can expand on that just a bit.
Mm. Yeah, I sure can. This is something that really hit me as I was engaged in working with fairy tales myself and seeing into the unconscious background of my psyche through the mirror of the story. There's a way in which, for instance, at Pacifica, it's very interesting to watch. If you say the story of the Frog King that most of us are familiar with, that famous story from Grimm's about the prince that's trapped in the body of a frog. If you throw that story out to a class of 35 people and ask them to give an interpretation of it, inevitably what starts to happen are, it's like a Rorschach test or a symbolic projected self-portraits of the individual start to come out in the way that they get into the story. What fascinates them in particular?
Mm-hmm.
What do they like? What do they not like? What characters do they identify with or not? And it's different for different people.
Sure.
For instance, it was very funny the other day. A student in class said they broke up into small groups to talk about that story, the Frog King, and she came back into the larger class and said, one of the things that happened in our group was we started getting really heated in our discussions and angry with each other. And then at one point I had to say, look, we're just talking about princesses and frogs, guys. But just not. This story is not about a princess or a frog, if you know what I mean. I mean, these are stories that touch complexes in us and the complexes that have archetypal cores. That means there's emotions involved, too. And the whole psychic background can get wrapped up in a fairy tale interpretation.
Were they getting into gender politics? Is that what they got heated about?
That's one of the things that comes up. The reactions of the women and the men in the class were very different.
Mm-hmm.
So they had the experience of fundamentalism.
Uh-huh.
You see, of people being connected to a certain image in an emotional way and fighting for it as the real truth.
Yeah. Now, this might be related to what you're saying. In your paper, you worried that maybe you were being too confessional. And then you go on to quote von Franz to the effect that, and quote, personalistic interpretations of archetypal narratives nullify their healing effect and obscure their deeper meaning. And I was a bit confused and puzzled when I read that. What are you and von Franz getting at there?
Well, what I was getting at was, you know, I'm writing this article and I'm talking about my own dream and my own experience. And, you know, as I'm going along with that, I thought, well, you know, this story is all about me. Maybe it's not, you know, really a great subject for an article. But then I realized that the importance of the motif is just that it isn't only about me, the understanding the sounds of animals. It's not just something idiosyncratic or personal to my life. It has a very wide significance that's non-personal. And coming into contact with that is healing. Coming into contact with what we would call the other world, the archetypal significance of our personal lives, is what heals and what makes us whole and gives a sense of meaning, the sense, one could say, of what story is living me, or what myth is dreaming me.
So is von Franz saying that if you stick just to the personal level without sort of getting to the archetypal, then it's not healing?
For her, it's not healing. You stick to what you already know. Or if you only project into the story, say, a psychology from the perspective of psychology, a theory or a concept, and explain the story through a theory, then you just see what you already know. Namely, the story becomes only a mirror for your theory, or kind of a proof for a pre-existing theory. And that's very different than getting into a motif and saying, I have no idea what this means, but I'm going to learn something about it and learn something new. So for von Franz, for instance, there are many stories that involve abandoned children. You think of Hansel and Gretel. You can think of many, many more in which there's an orphan child or an abandoned child. This abandoned child in folk tales almost always becomes the new hero. Von Franz's perspective is, if you interpret that abandoned child in a folk tale as a real child, say, and project the family drama of our time onto that character, then you miss that deeper healing significance of the image, which is the new principle, the new creative principle, is coming from what's lost, what's alone, what's orphaned, what has no home yet in the culture. And just like with the Jesus story, this one that has no home often becomes the locus for a whole new sense of meaning in the culture, a sense of renewal. That's what she would mean by the archetypal significance of these motifs. And for me, it really is getting in contact with that sense of deeper meaning in us that we don't yet know, and that we don't know through our theories either, through these images.
I'm struck by that idea of discovering what we don't know, and that's something I kind of wrestle with. I know that the same idea applies to dream work, and often I have the experience, I have a dream, and I think I know what it means.
Yeah. Well, me too. I mean, it's natural. Of course we do that. Oh, I know exactly what that is.
Yeah.
And that's exactly not it. I was so impressed by the analysts that I trained with in Switzerland, the Swiss analysts there, that in case colloquia, we would, for instance, go through a dream, and they would go through the dream so slowly. It would be first sentence, an hour later, second sentence. You know, and when you really do that, the whole dream itself can open up and illuminate in ways that you had no idea about at the start. Wow. So it's exactly not that to think at the first, I know what that is. And, you know, interpretations that start that way become very boring, don't they? I mean, eventually you just see the same thing over and over and over, and it becomes very boring.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's hard, though. This is what the poet John Keats called negative capability, which is a hard, something difficult to develop. The capacity, he said, to remain in mysteries, doubts, and uncertainties without any irritable reaching out after fact or reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That reminds me of James Hillman, too. I think he was kind of, didn't he sort of champion not foreclosing on meanings, but accepting the images kind of as they are?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, stick with the image. Stick with the image. And James Hillman really, you know, he highly valued Jung's Red Book. He thought if you could only save one book in the fire out of Jung's library, it would be the Red Book.
Wow.
Because the Red Book has really no psychology language in it at all, no conceptual language at all or theoretical language, but it's filled with vivid mythopoetic imagery. And that imagery is the real truth of the soul, the real language of the soul is speaking in that mythopoetic image. So it's not as if reducing the image to a concept is a better thing to do for Hillman. It's not. It's best to stick with the visceral, emotional, gripping qualities of the living image that has the most truth in it, not the least truth.
Wow. One of the things that emerges out of your article is that the unconscious animal within us is not only the source of conflict and destruction, but also a potential ally to be befriended. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. I would say both. Both. The animal nature of our soul is not only nice and friendly, it can be potentially destructive. And if it possesses us, which is the folklore motif of being turned into an animal, right, which is different than relating to or speaking to the animals. If one is turned into an animal, that means possessed by that layer of the psyche, that's a curse that one needs to be redeemed from.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, what von Franz said, for instance, in all of the folklore she studied from all around the world, there were no universal sort of rules that she could pin down, with one exception, and that is that if the hero or heroine in the story obeys or follows the advice of the helpful animal, always they turn out right, always. And if they fundamentally disregard that advice or kill the helpful animal, they always go downhill. They go down the tubes. So it is significant that way. The danger, the animal layer, is different than the collective conventional layer of social appropriateness.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's vital, and it's alive, and it's full of wisdom. So it's this paradoxical image of learning to successfully deal with that animal, so to say, that is often the subject of folklore.
Yeah. You make frequent references to alchemy in your article. How does alchemy fit in with what we've been discussing here, learning to understand the language of the animals?
Well, alchemy, Jung thought of fairy tales as alchemy for everyone. The alchemists were often the highly elite, very well-educated members of their society, the poets, the mystics, the theologians, the doctors, the scholars. But one can find alchemical motifs in the folklore as well. For instance, the redemption of the feminine, the sense of nature being alive, having a soul. How to negotiate with evil, how to deal with evil. The great motif in alchemy, of course, is the so-called mysterium conjunctionis, in Latin, the mystery of the conjunction of opposites. And many fairy tales have that as their goal at the end, the marriage, the wedding, or the idea in fairy tales that eventually two worlds come together, the royal world and the ordinary world.
And they often have that line, they live happily ever after. So that would be that conjunction as well?
That conjunction as well, that one has to see really as a symbol and not take literally, which is often where people get in trouble with fairy tales, is they think too literally about them and think of that wedding as an actual wedding. And they say, well, that really never happens in real life. But if you see it as a symbol for the union of opposites, and it's fundamentally something mysterious, you can find the parallels with alchemy there, for instance.
I mentioned earlier my own love of fairy tales, particularly when I was a kid. But there's one of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales that stuck with me all my life. And in fact, I've integrated into a class that I teach called Myth, Dream, and Symbol. And often I end up giving a very dramatic telling of that story. And I'd love to see what sort of Jungian sense you might make of it here, if you're willing.
Sure, I'd be willing to give it a go.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great, by the way.
We're out a net here.
Yeah.
The story I'm thinking of is called The Tinder Box. And I thought maybe I'd give an abbreviated narration of it here rather than my full dramatic elaborated telling. And I'll pause at significant beats in the story for you to offer some interpretation up to that point. Would that work for you?
Sure, that sounds good. We'll have a back and forth with the story. Sounds good.
Yeah. Okay, so here's how the story starts out. There's a soldier, and this is, you know, in a long, long ago in a land far, far away. A soldier is released from service, and he's walking down the road, and he encounters an old woman, might be called a hag or a witch, who makes him an offer. So I'll stop there.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is just to point out something kind of in the background, which is these stories that grip us and fascinate us, you know, one has to keep in mind the possibility that they really are saying something significant about our fate or destiny in life, especially if you think of, for the listeners out there, to think of perhaps the story, the film that gripped them as a child.
Yes.
You know, the one that you had to listen to over and over and over and over. Often if people can get in touch with that, it's saying, the story is saying something very significant about their path through life and their fate. So I just want to, you know, kind of put that out in the background.
Yeah, I've always thought that too. And I've invited students to try to remember if there was such a story for them, and maybe to write about that a little bit. But go ahead. So you talk about our fate, and of course, I immediately think of the road as a being on the road, and we have all these road literatures filled with stories of being on the road, and we have a book titled On the Road. And so it really seems like it's a metaphor for the path of life.
Yeah, and at this story, a particular path of life, it's often good to start with fairy tales by looking at who are the characters at the start of the story and where is the setting taking place.
Yeah.
And compare that with the end. Who are the characters at the end and what has happened? Because one can get a sense of the purpose of the story or what it's trying to get at by doing that. This is a story about a soldier who's been released from military service, and he's walking back. So this is a return journey, the image of a man who's gone out into the world, who's fought the battles of life, who's developed a strong ego, who's a mature personality, and now he's on this return journey back home. So he's going to encounter something different than he has in this typically masculine way of adaptation, one could say, that he's already accomplished. Something new is going to come up, a new encounter.
Oh, that's good. See, I've got a new take on it here, just like it's supposed to happen, right? When you bounce it off somebody else, I'm getting a new viewpoint that I hadn't really given much thought to the fact that he's a soldier and what you just said about he's returning and he, a mature personality and all of that. That's something for me to reflect on.
Yeah, and this is endless that we'll continue to have those reflections, I think.
Yeah, and something I never really thought about before is that in terms of my own story, I mean, the guy is a soldier. I was born during wartime. And I know that had a strong imprint, even though I never had to go to service. But as a male, I've always felt that, you know, I might have to go to war. And that's been a sort of burden. Both a burden and probably, you know, as a young kid, it seemed like an exciting, wonderful prospect.
Sure, both. Yeah, no, that's really good. That's the personal experience of that image for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what about the witch? I mean, talk about your gender politics here. That's an image that is ever popular in fairy tales, but not so much in contemporary culture.
Yeah, this is, I would say this, naming that type of woman as a witch is the cultural layer of the story. It's the way that culture in Europe imagines and experiences that feminine layer, that darker feminine layer of the soul that's connected to nature in a deep imaginative way. That in Europe is a witch. Well, that's a cultural, conclusion, one could say. One could also say she's the archetype of the wise old woman, and including the dark dimensions of nature. And in the European culture, we've grown far from accepting that and regarding that as something acceptable. Therefore she pops up in the folklore of European stories in paradoxical ways. For this particular individual, he's in the circumstance, for instance, a psychotherapy client of mine once said, just starting psychotherapy, I asked him, what's your problem? He said, I'm perpetually broke and perpetually single. So, you know, this is a fairy tale sort of starting. And what this hero then is going to do is encounter the feminine. He's going to have to turn radically towards the feminine. That means away from power, activity, success, and as Jung would say, in the individuation process, turn towards what's lacking in his development and what's been rejected in his culture. And that's a scary thing to do, a paradoxical, scary thing to do. It seems like that's the setting as the story opens up.
Okay. And, of course, Campbell's Journey of the Heroes had a big impact on me and my thinking. And so I see this part that also as in terms of the Campbell's call to adventure, that this guy is just kind of walking down the road and, you know, leading a ordinary kind of life, but then this witch pops up and makes him an offer, and that's kind of a break right there from from how things were going.
I would completely agree. Yeah, and the call to adventure is paradoxical. It's not always welcome or a nice, happy thing that it involves.
So back to the story. This witch makes the soldier an offer. She gestures towards this tree trunk, which turns out is hollow, and it leads down into the earth, down to a cave below. And she asks him if he'll go down, if he will allow her to lower him down with a rope into this cave, where he will encounter three rooms filled with different kinds of treasure. In the first room, he'll find lots of copper. In the second room, lots of silver. In the third room, lots of gold. But there's a problem. Each of these rooms is guarded by a dog. So there are three giant dogs, one with the eyes the size of saucers, the second dog with eyes the size of dinner plates, and the third one with eyes the size of mill wheels.
So, isn't that weird?
But he's going to be able to pass these obstacles if he uses her apron that the apron, if he'll put each dog as he encounters them onto her apron, then he'll be able to pick up the treasure without the dog getting him. And all she wants in return for this is for him to fetch her tinder box. And for listeners, a tinder box would, you know, that's pre-cigarette lighters and maybe even pre-matches. It's a way to start a fire with flint and a little bit of tinder that will catch fire easily and strike the flint against steel. And so I guess that's what they used in those days. So this image, particularly of the three dogs, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why this story has stuck with me so much, is those, I could really picture those dogs with their large glowing eyes of the three sizes. So, so that was a big, a whole bunch of stuff in that part. Let me, stop here and, listen to your reflections.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is the weird, strange language of fairy tales now that we're in the midst of. This imagery is not Hans Christian Andersen's invention, and it's certainly not the invention of European culture. So this is what Jung meant by the archetypal layer of the psyche that speaks in these bizarre images. To us, to the conscious mind, these are just strange, strange images. One doesn't know quite what to make of them at all. The first thing is, of course, one has to take these as metaphor, as symbol, and not take the thing literally. And that might seem obvious, but I really want to emphasize that point. If one takes this imagery literally, of course, it's just nonsense. It's just delusion. It's nothing. But if one can start to try to see it as symbol, it can be taken seriously, although not literally.
So where do you go with that?
Well, so the metaphors, for instance, of the tree that extends up into the air and goes down into the earth, and going down into the tree, he has to get lowered down by the witch into something that's under the ground inside of the tree, is a metaphor that you find in shamanism quite a lot. You find it in ancient mystery initiations, for instance, the Eleusinian Mysteries, which were the most famous initiation rites in the ancient Greek world involved that kind of image of going down into the underworld to encounter something strange and then returning back again. So these are the pre-European roots of some kind of initiation rite that's no longer part of the culture, and this person is going to have to engage in it. It's fundamentally a feminine initiation involving this witch. So then he has to go down into what we would call the unconscious. Mm-hmm. Jung had these types of dreams early on in his experiences. He had dreams that he was in his house. There were other rooms in his house. He had to descend through down the staircase of one of those rooms and gradually hit deeper and deeper layers of the psyche, coming upon a room that had to do with the 18th century, another room with the Middle Ages, and then finally into a cave in which there was just skeletons and bones, a very primal layer of the soul. This is the type of dream imagery that led him to formulate his theories of the collective unconscious.
Right.
So one might say psychologically, this is an image of having to go down into deeper strata of psychic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a light down there in the underworld too, and there's doors, right, and there's chests. In other words, there's cultural artifacts. He doesn't just descend into primal nature. Other people have been down there before. So he's descending into a deeper cultural layer of the human experience. And there he encounters these three dogs. Of course, the dog is a very common representation of what guards the underworld. If you think of Kerberos in the Greek mythology, that huge dog with three heads is guarding the underworld, the entrance to Hades. Or Anubis in the Egyptian mythology was the dog god that had to do with the underworld. So he's having to encounter something that, you know, you could say it's an encounter with animal instinct, an encounter with his own animal nature. Mm-hmm. And that's the guardian of the treasure. He has to learn to deal with that to get the treasure. The way to deal with it, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say just to point out the way that he has to learn to deal with that animal side of the soul isn't by clubbing it to death or taking his sword out and killing it, which would be his primary adaptation as a soldier, but this strange image of taking the apron of the witch and putting the dogs on that apron. It's a very mysterious symbol that has to do with a feminine way to contain the animal drives or the instinctual nature. And this is where, you know, one might have to do a lot more research to really get to what that motif is getting at. But in general, some way to contain and perhaps understand and relate to that layer of the soul that's different than attacking it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Again, that opens up a new avenue for me, the idea of using a feminine solution to the challenge. I had seen that as a good example of Campbell's amulet. He talks about when you pass through the threshold, often you encounter supernatural helpers, and sometimes you're given an amulet by the guardian of the threshold. And so I've in the past I've looked at this part in that term from that point of view, but I like the way that you're bringing in the feminine. And if I ever teach about it again, I want to be sure to make that point.
Yeah, it's a different way of adapting than he's used to.
Yeah.
Take the apron of the woman.
So moving the story along, the soldier goes through those trials. He encounters each of the dogs. He takes treasure from each of the rooms. First, he fills his pockets with copper, but then when he encounters the silver, somehow he empties his pockets and goes for the silver and then comes to the gold and realizes, hey, gold's worth a lot more than silver. And so he now fills himself up with the gold. And then he's back, you know, at the opening, looking up through the tree trunk from down below, can see the sky up there and can see the witch's ugly face peering down at him. I'm slipping into the dramatic telling.
Good.
Here.
No, I love it. I love it. Yeah.
And she says, she calls down to him, did you get my tinderbox, sonny? He says, yeah, I've got the tinderbox. And she says, well, tie it to the rope so I can bring it up. And he says, oh, no, you pull me up. And I'll give you the tinderbox once you pull me up. So she grumbles about that, but she pulls him up. And as soon as he gets up, he ends up, I think he demands to know why does she want the tinderbox so much? And she refuses to tell him. So he whips out his sword and he cuts off her head. And I will pause there.
That doesn't seem very nice of him, but
right.
You know, this reminds me actually of a story now that you're telling it of a Grimm's tale called The Blue Light, and I just will mention that for your readers as a parallel from another fairy tale. So this is the motif of descent and then return.
Yeah.
And he's able to go down into that underworld, successfully deal with those dogs that are terrifying, and the eyes you especially mentioned that must be something to be seen by that animal in a way, and brings back the money, but then also brings back something that appears to be even more valuable than the money, at least to the witch, which is this strange symbol of the tinderbox. This, for me, is a beautiful image, this tinderbox. Very strange again, but one could say this is related. You mentioned alchemy and the relationship between fairy tales and alchemy. The alchemists often talked about what they called a light in nature, a lumen naturae, or a deus terrenus, a kind of god that's in the earth. This is a beautiful symbol for me, this tinderbox, of the ability to create light out of darkness. And it's one we could talk about for a long, long time. But evidently something that has even more value than money, although we don't know why at this point in the story. The soldier then, upon returning up, has to cut the head off that witch. Jung would say that this is in the encounter with the unconscious often starts out in this paradoxical way as a call to adventure, but also as a destruction. The witch, as she appears in the dreams of contemporary men, often has the meaning of a depression or an addiction, something that drags us and leads us into the underworld, so to speak, the unconscious, but that has a potentially destructive aspect to it, a negative mother complex, one could say, a pull towards regression. Perhaps that witch would just take the light and keep it all to herself. And in that sense, one could say the new consciousness that could have come up is going to return back into unconsciousness again. And the ego in this fairy tale has to defend its own values against those of the unconscious. Cutting the head off a witch, one can find in many stories, and it has to do, just in the most general way, with overcoming that potentially regressive pull.
That the son has to differentiate himself from the mother, and particularly from the negative aspects of the mother?
Yeah, and understood as a metaphor, that would mean the negative aspects of his own unconscious, mm-hmm. if this were the dream of an actual man. For instance, there's a dream I ran across recently that was just like this fairy tale. A man who is in a very severe depression had a dream. He was sunk in this underworld chamber, and a witch came in, and he had to fight with her, and he was able to overcome her. And then with her daughter, got her daughter then and returned back to life again. And that had the sense of overcoming a very serious depression. It's a dangerous aspect of the unconscious, mm-hmm. or the ego. Mm-hmm. The unconscious isn't only nice and helpful, it's paradoxical. This witch is a paradoxical figure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm reminded of the Star Wars movies, too, and the sword fighting under the ground with Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, and Darth Vader. Somehow, even though he's not a feminine figure, but there is that.
Absolutely, yeah. Having to overcome something potentially negative, and then it transforms. I mean, this is, Jung would say, the starting of the encounter with the anima starts off as a witch, and then you'll see it probably transforms to other feminine images.
Yes, indeed. So moving the story along, strange that you should mention that. The soldier is now rich. He's got all this money. He goes to town, and it almost becomes like the prodigal son, you know, in the New Testament, because he engages in riotous living. He hears about the beautiful princess who's locked in the castle. So there's that transformation of the feminine that you were kind of foreseeing. He exhausts all of his money in riotous living. And he's in his attic, and he wants to have a smoke, and he remembers the tinder box, and he strikes it to light his pipe, and lo and behold, the dog with eyes the size of teacups appears, saying, what command has my master for his slave? So he sends the dog off for money so he can be rich again. And there's a whole literature of wasted magical wishes. I'll let you comment here.
Yeah, this is like Aladdin and his lamp also, isn't it?
Yes.
So he thinks of this, there's a beautiful princess locked in a castle, which is one of the typical fairy tale motifs of having to redeem this princess. This is another image of the feminine that's far away, but will be a goal to attain, to bring her down out of that castle into real life, to connect with his soul, the anima, no longer as mother, but as partner. And as a soul image that, and the way to do it involves this tinderbox. So, yeah, he's wealthy. He has all this money. He uses the money up. Well, I can only say that there's it's typical that people start off psychotherapy with ideas about why the hell should I do this underworld journey. And one often thinks, well, to get better, or to become more successful, or to become more adapted, to have more energy. And those are all things that are symbolized by money, energy, collective adaptation. And of course, it's what the soldier lacks at the start of the story. He has no money at all, and that's a scary situation. So one understands the impulse to want to have money. But then at the other hand, he has this tinderbox, and it's a more mysterious and more valuable thing that's there in his encounter with the unconscious, and he doesn't fully appreciate that yet. It has to do with a spark of light in nature, one might say, an inner creativity, the ability to make light out of the darkness, imagination itself, and that's related to this princess. And this is the value of Eros, the story of love, the story of somehow a connection to his own soul that he doesn't fully appreciate yet. If he were a real man, one might think of it like that.
Well, once he's got his money, then he remembers the princess, and so he sends the dog with eyes the size of teacups to bring her to his apartment. And to put it politely, they bond. And mm-hmm. and next morning, she tells the queen that she had a dream that she was riding on an enormous dog.
Oh, beautiful. I mean, this is a beautiful, beautiful image. The sleeping soul, the sleeping beauty that arrives at his apartment on the back of an enormous dog. That's a striking symbol. It means that this instinctual layer, his own animal side, is what brings the soul image to him. And she's still asleep. That means still unconscious. That's a paradox, because that means our rage, our instinctuality, sexuality, bodily drives, everything that might be symbolized by that dog is what brings up the sleeping soul and the problem of love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Moving the story along, I love that, by the way. Now, moving the story along, one of the serving ladies follows the princess on the dog, and the next evening, and marks the door of the soldier's house with a large X. Mm. But when the queen's men go searching for the house, they discover that all the doors have been marked with an X.
I don't like her very much. This is the feeling function of stories, what you like and don't like. This is the maid of the king and queen, right, who's discovered something that's verboten, not allowed. This often represents the negative side of the ruling principles, the collective ideas of a culture that are symbolized by the king and queen, the status quo. The collectivity does not want this event to take place.
And there's trickster energy here, right, in terms of marking all the doors with X.
You're right. There's a lot of trickster energy. Tricks. Who's tricking who?
Mm-hmm.
She tries to trick him. He tricks her, or his dogs trick her. right. Absolutely. A lot of the trickster.
Okay. Moving the story along, the third night, the queen fills the princess's pocket with fine white powder flour to create a trail. And this time they're able to follow the trail, and the soldier's thrown into prison. He is able to communicate with a boy out on the street through the prison bar window and ask the boy to go to his lodgings and fetch his tinderbox. And the soldier is going to be hanged, and all the royalty and the town are gathered to see him hanged.
Amazing.
And for his last wish, he asks to smoke a pipe and strikes his tinderbox three times, and the three dogs fall upon the judges and counselors and the king and queen, and the people proclaim the soldier the new king, and the princess becomes his queen.
Well, this is the typical ending to many fairy tales, this sense of renewal. The old king and queen are dethroned, and the new king and queen come. So it's a sense of cultural renewal, you could say, symbolically, the renewal of the guiding ideas and values of a culture. Now, this guy didn't do anything wrong. I mean, what was his crime? He wanted to release the princess from her tower and connect with her. And if we think of her as a soul image, it's this idea of then a typical path through life for a man that involves a descent into the underworld, into the unconscious, an encounter with the feminine world, and the fate to find his own soul. And the collective in this story views that as a crime.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Jung also talked about. He often referred to individuation. What Jung meant by that was the sense of becoming whole, of becoming oneself, living from the instinctual basis of one, the depths of one's being, is often what Jung called it, involves tragic guilt, because one is no longer contained and no longer going according to the status quo of the culture, according to the collective ideas of what one should be, of how one should behave. One has become a criminal in a sense, because one's veered off on one's own path, and that seems to be what is going on in this story. So he's going to be hanged for trying to connect to the sleeping anima, to his own soul.
Yeah.
And then he remembers the tinderbox and he strikes it and the dogs come. So, I mean, for me, this is a beautiful image of, one could say, artists have this type of a fate that through their creativity, that's the spark of light that shines in their soul, that illumination that can connect to the instinctual depths of things and to nature, that overthrows the bourgeois collective principles that are too rigid and are not willing to suffer renewal. And this is a motif in many stories of the old king that won't let go of the throne, because all cultures need renewal. So at the end, that's what happens, and the collective ways of how one should be are overthrown by the person who's connected to the depths, who's connected to this light in nature and the instinctuality of that. So I like the ending.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, one likes it, you know, feel it's good.
And when you view it in that way, might you use a fairy tale like this in the course of therapy? And if so, how?
Oh, absolutely. One way in which you can use these sorts of stories is as parallels to people's dreams. And there's many dreams that involve themes like this, of going down into the underworld, coming across dogs or other dangerous animals down there, dreams of a sleeping beauty of some sort and then another trapped somewhere. These are very common, and if you can amplify the dreams with folk tales like this, it really gives one the sense that, what's happening in my own soul, my own inner process, isn't only something idiosyncratic or strange to me. There's a story in me that's living me, that has lived other people too.
Mm-hmm.
Jung said, for instance, if I'm in a dark hole, I feel much better if others are down there with me.
Did you say that?
yeah. You know, and these sorts of stories give us that feeling, especially in terms of darkness and disorientation, because the motif of having to go down through the witch, lowered into the underworld, psychologically, that's a depression or something that's it's not fun to live through. And the sense that there could be a meaning in what seems to be dark,
mm-hmm.
Or if one's lost one's way in a midlife crisis, like this soldier, you could say, is a story of the way that human beings have, for many, many centuries, recognized the value of what we would call a midlife crisis, is on the return journey in midlife, having to encounter the unconscious in a new way. Artists might have a dream like this. This is a fate that might befall an artist or a creative person.
Mm-hmm. I worry about what's being lost in the Disneyification of fairy tales. And I just worry that children will think that they know the tale because they saw the movie or they read the little golden book version. Mm-hmm. Do you worry about that at all?
Yeah, I do too, Dr. Dave. And it's strange for me because on the one hand, Disney, for instance, does such an amazing job with their films, with humor and just the characters. And I like the films, but the Rapunzel one recently, Twisted,
yes,
for instance, I saw with my kids and I really liked it. But on the other hand, the danger for me is that some of the strange motifs and some of the details of the stories that one can't really understand or that seem bizarre are left out. And cut away, and that seems to be a danger for me. And then also the tendency to make the stories politically correct,
mm-hmm.
you know, also is understandable, but also a strange thing for me too.
And I also wonder about the importance of a common language, a common cultural inheritance in which everyone has grown up with the same stories. And I think people who grew up with those older tales, they had that. I'm not sure if we have that now.
Mm.
Or are we getting it from the Disney movies? Well, adults of the future think back fondly of Rapunzel as Disney portrayed it.
It could be. I mean, I don't really know the answer. That, for instance, you mentioned Joseph Campbell, and Joseph Campbell had a huge influence on George Lucas. George Lucas said that he wanted to write a modern fairy tale with Star Wars, and then he ran across Joseph Campbell's books, The Hero's Journey, those types of books, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and developed a relationship with Joseph Campbell. So in a way, that's a modern fairy tale for us. And another way, you touch on something that's so deep and central, and certainly to Jung's way of thinking, is, and that's the loss of a sustaining living myth in our culture and the psychological effects of that. Jung wrote a lot about that. Jung really experienced that in his own life. He was visiting the people, the Taos Pueblos in New Mexico, traveling to Africa, experiencing cultures that had a living mythology. And then he had to ask himself, well, now what is my myth, the myth that I really live in? And he said, then there was a uncomfortable silence.
Mm.
And he had to discover that from within. And well, it's a big question. What is the new myth of our culture? Where is that coming from? What does that look like? We live in a time, I think many, many people have recognized, of the disintegration of the guiding mythologies that once held people together, church and state and patriotism, and those have crumbled for many people. So,
yeah, and certainly we know that when primitive cultures lose their myth, they lose their story, they do disintegrate. You know, that's when alcoholism starts and other kinds of addictions, and things just fall apart without that sort of guiding meaning.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's us today. I mean, that isn't just the people that now have to live on reservations, but that's our a lot of people that come into psychotherapy, there's a sense of rootlessness, of alienation, lack of community, addictions, obsessions, depressions. The living mythology has the function of connecting people to a sense of relationship to the cosmos and to life in a meaningful way, but also into a community in a meaningful way.
And yeah. Well, look, I've kept you a lot longer than I think either one of us planned on, but it's been absolutely delightful. As we wind down, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Oh, I don't think so. Just, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation and the chance to talk with you about this. The subject, Dr. Dave, really.
Well, me too. Yeah. Tom Elsner, thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Tom Elsner as much as I did. I let this one run long because of my love for fairy tales and because I felt so comfortable with Tom. So I'll keep my comments here quite brief. I mentioned this interview to my wife and discovered she has her own take on fairy tales. She pointed out that almost all of them seem to aim at teaching children the value of being clever. Indeed, many even have the word clever in the title, for example, Clever Hans and The Clever Tailor, among others. According to her, they emphasize cleverness over goodness and other traditional virtues. I must confess that point had never occurred to me before, and, as usual, she has a very good point. I wish I had spoken to her before the interview. I would have been interested in Tom's reaction to her observation. I felt Tom and I had great rapport, and I look forward to having him on the show again in the future. As a matter of fact, I asked him if there might be another topic that he would favor us with down the line, and he suggested another one of my favorites, which is synchronicity. So keep your ears tuned for that one of these days.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now.
Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink wrap radio. All right.
Hey, everybody. This is where I would normally put lots of announcements about all kinds of things and encourage you to keep your donations coming in and so on. But this show has run so long already. I've got some great announcements. I've got new transcripts on the site. I've got great email to read. But I want to get this show out, and I don't want to tax your time, so I'm going to cut it short and skip the announcements and the reading of the email until next time.
Hi, this is psychologist, psychoanalyst, and political activist Dr. Stephen Soltz, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Yes, Dr. Stephen Soltz will be my guest on the next episode with a hard-hitting critique on the dark side of Martin Seligman's Comprehensive Soldier Fitness Program. So join us then. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.